All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? Today on the show, I talked to Ethan Russell. He's a photographer. Now, look, you know, I get stuff in the mail all the time, man. I get pictures. I get books of pictures. But this one, you know, the cover of it is Keith Richards walking off the Rolling Stones chartered plane in 1972. And I'm like, what is this? And in it, there's just these amazing pictures of, you know, John Lennon and Yoko and the Stones and the Who and the Eagles are in there. Linda Ronstadt, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Taj Mahal, Benny Goodman. They're just, but some of the, Brian Jones, some of the last pictures of Brian Jones before he died. And more importantly, not even more importantly, but there were pictures from Altamont. He was on stage at Altamont. And I'm a little obsessed with Altamont. And tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of Altamont. There's a lot of different schools of documentation of the Altamont situation, but by all indications, by all sort of recollections and pieces on it, it was a clusterfuck of a very high magnitude and a very dark, fucking horrendous day. And Ethan Russell was there and he took pictures. And if you get the book, you'll recognize a lot of the pictures. And I told you, I get a lot of these books and I like them, but for some reason, maybe it's this moment in my life, yeah, I'm really at the tail end of the boomer thing. This was not my life. I did not live through it, but I came to it later, the Stones, the Beatles, you know, they were already well on their way. But there was something about these pictures that really kind of nails something. I mean, he's just got a great eye and he's got a great way of framing. And some of them you just remember from your life, from seeing them. He did that classic, you know, picture of Keith in front of the sign, "Be patient, a drug-free America is a better America," whatever it is. But it's like seminal. I mean, you know that picture. And he sent it to me. He self-publishes this book. It's called The Best Seat in the House. And you can get it as a book, also as an interactive digital version at ethanrussell.com. And, you know, he self-published this thing, and he just sent it to me, and I love it. So he came down, and he's living up in the Bay Area. He came down, and we talked about it. But I just found it very humanizing and very great, and we had a great conversation. So I'm going to talk to him in a minute. And as I said, 50 years ago, Altamont. And this also got me sort of reflecting about things and trying to realize what was my life versus what was the life that I revered from a different time, you know? I'm a little delirious. I'm a little bit in denial. LaFonda, my cat, is it digressing? I don't know. It's happening kind of quickly. I thought it was, you hang on to hope. I did not have hope that she would last another year. I thought it would be nice, but she's just so weak. And, you know, when I give her subcutaneous fluids, it's really kind of, stressful, and I'm just really getting acclimated to the idea that I got to do this soon. She's not in pain, but she's not having any fun either. Maybe I'm projecting that, but it's just, she's just not going to put on any weight. And I don't know, you guys. I'm trying to deal. People have been very supportive. I'm getting a lot of good emails. I think when I do make the decision to do it, I'm going to have a vet come here and we'll do it. We'll sit there and do it if I can hold her and get through it. It's very sad and bizarre to me that, you know, I actually have a kind of, you know, I have 15 years of memories with this cat at different points. You know, these are the cats I found living out in back of my apartment in Astoria, Queens, feral kittens, truly feral. They were not, they were too old to be domesticated, really. They were quite wild for years, but I just have all these insane memories. And I guess not unlike humans when they get sick. She's just not herself. She's never going to be herself again. Her will is very diminished, almost completely. And it's sad. And, you just got to wonder when it just feels like it's time. I was laying on the floor. I'm feeding her with my hands and my fingers. And now today, for some reason, she just started to hide more. And, you know, she was trying to put up a good appearances for a while and towing up on the couch downstairs and hanging out, sleeping with me. But today it just seems worse. And I gave her the fluids, but I don't know to what end. And like I always say, you know, there's always cats available. There's always cats around, but you get so attached to these things. And I'm not sad that a couple of my longest relationships in terms of live-in relationships are with these cats. Monkey's doing okay, but Fonda, I'm not going to do a goddamn in memoriam today, but I think it's going to happen soon. I know it's going to happen soon. I know I got to do it, and I'll make the call. I'll do it. I'm not going to wait too long. It's just, it's not even that. So, of course, it's sad, but it's the right thing to do, and there's a way to do it, so, you know, they don't know. I'll know. I got a weird email from a guy that says he had the vet come over and do it at the house, but then they took the cat's body away, and he felt bad that he didn't give his other pets time with the dead cat or dog. I don't remember what it was. And do I need to do that? I mean, are they going to be grieving, or just are they going to just be like, well, that's that. I guess they're not here anymore. Do I have to hang out and leave the body around? I don't think so, right? I mean, it seemed like something, you know, he regrets, but I don't know if it's a reasonable thing. I don't know. My cats have adjusted to them disappearing before. I don't think I can quite handle that. And I'm trying to decide whether do I get her cremated and keep the stuff in a thing? Is it, you know, these are just avoiding the truth, which is that, you know, I'm going to have to let her go. And that's that. You know, ashes, no ashes. I'm just going to have to do this, and it's going to be sad. And I feel like I've been preparing myself for the last couple weeks, and it's coming down to the wire, people. And I don't want to bum you out. It is what it is. And I would like to mention that Christmas is coming, and there's new WTF merch for the holidays at podswag.com/WTF. We got baseball hats, winter beanies. We got new shirts, new mugs, new travel cups. There's a lot of new stuff. You know, a lot of it has the new Draplin logo on there. It's all at podswag.com/WTF, or you can go to WTFpod.com and click on the merch button. So it's a little heavy over here. As I said, it's heavy. It's heavy. But I'm blessed. Can I say that? I'm blessed, or I'm fortunate. Perhaps not blessed. You know, I'm fortunate. My parents are still alive. I have not had any, you know, people in my immediate family fall ill. I have not fallen ill. My cat is 15 years old, and I guess that's in her 70s in human years, and she's old and fragile, and she's dying. But this is how I'm experiencing that. Somehow or another, I wasn't around for the deaths of my other pets. And, you know, I'm around for this. I'm here for this. And it's just, you know, it's not a wake-up call, but it just, I'm 56, man. It's just sort of, the years are creeping up, man. So what else is happening? I did a big fitting for my role in the upcoming Aretha Franklin biopic called Respect. It's always fun to kind of do a real fitting. I went over to a wardrobe house with some wardrobe folks from the movie and got to try on all these different outfits from the late 60s and early 70s. And it was kind of exciting. It really kind of starts to wrap you in the character. And then I went and got fitted for some glasses of the period and kind of wraps you in the character a little more. And, you know, then I start to talk a little bit like this. And I start to feel like the guy a little bit. And, you know, things are starting to come together for me. There's an intensity to him. And I think that, you know, it's starting to come together. I think the facial hair is going to look right. And I think that there's a way I can approach it. You know, he was a bit of a rager, which is good for me. And sure, that's where I'm at with it. But look, I'm excited about that. I did some ADR, some voiceover work on the David Bowie film that I did, which looks a lot better than I anticipated. And so that's kind of exciting. It looks like that might get, at the very least, become a finished movie. And that's that. You know, I'm going to do a little stand-up. I'm going to add some more tour dates so I can get out to a few places. I'm going to hit the Eastern Seaboard a little bit in the middle of winter because that's a smart idea. I think I scheduled some dates in Maine and New Hampshire and Long Island and am I going to maybe Connecticut? I'm not. I'll let you know. Going to do a couple of Florida dates in February. All right. I'll let you know what's up, Tampa, Orlando. Yeah, I'm going to do a couple Florida dates, and I stay away from that. And I'm going to do a Cleveland date and I believe a Michigan date. Is that right? I think it is right. I'll let you know. But I'm going to do about 7 dates, you know, before the special drops with the material that I've been doing because I can, and there's some places that I haven't been back to in a while, so that's going to happen. And we're going to start shooting the fourth and final season of GLOW in March. And that's that. And, you know, it's kind of that time of year where things slow down a bit here between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's just this holiday chunk. It's been nice and rainy here in LA, which means no fires. And I'm just trying to, you know, I'm trying to stay okay with what I got to do. I hope you guys are well. And now I want to introduce my guest, if I could. Would that be okay? Ethan Russell is a photographer, as I said earlier. The Best Seat in the House is a book available as a book and also an interactive digital version at ethanrussell.com. It's a great bunch of photographs. And we talk about Altamont because tomorrow, December 6th, is the 50th anniversary of that fucking nightmare. And Ethan photographed it. And this is me talking to Ethan Russell. Where do you live?
North of San Francisco now.
Now I see. So you're not. I didn't know really what your background was. You're not British.
Not Brits.
But you spent a lot of time there.
I did, and I fooled a lot of Americans because I came back, and
yeah,
they thought I was British.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you speak with a British accent on purpose?
No. Sort of never did that. Right.
Well, I mean, thanks for sending the book. I don't know why you sent it, but I was very excited about it. I had no idea who you were, and I get this amazing book in the mail, and I looked through it, and I've gotten a lot of these kind of books before, the photographs, you know. I mean, I talked to Neil Preston.
Okay, there you go.
You know Neil?
Yeah.
You guys, there's a few shots that just sort of transcend time, and they are there forever. Right. And he got the one with Robert Plant in the bird.
Right.
That was his big, that was the moment, man.
Yeah, right.
And you got like, there's so many in here that I've known all my life, like of Jagger, of Richards, of The Who, The Beatles, even later on in the book, Ronstadt and the Altamont pictures, the Rock and Roll Circus pictures. But so many of them were pictures from my childhood, ones I've always known.
Right.
And to get the book, I was like, wow. And I've looked at it like 3 or 4 times, and I'm like still excited about it. So that's fun. And just even the cover shot. What's that, 72, the plane, the Stones plane?
That's what it is, 72 getting off the plane. That's when they got the logo.
And the weird thing is, like, now tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of Altamont. And I just had a discussion with someone the other day. There's going to be a time where all of these guys are going to go. They're going to be gone.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not far away.
Yeah.
And it's sort of heartbreaking. But like this book is sort of a testament to, you know, hopefully, I don't know how the next generation will process all this stuff. But it's certainly, for me, and I'm a little younger on the boomer spectrum, you know, a very nostalgic and beautiful, you know, archive of stuff.
Well, thank you. I think it's true. I mean, the world changes, so you don't know, right?
Right. Well, it just gets plowed under.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? I mean, some songs will persist. But so how does it start for you? You grew up in the Bay Area?
Born in New York, came across the country, right, when I was 8.
Eight. Yeah.
Yeah. And then grew up in San Francisco, basically, Northern California.
So your folks made the move?
My father made the move back, actually. He was from a divorced family, so I'm thinking 31, 32 in that era.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he worked for BBDO, and he was the original producer on the Hit Parade.
Really? Your father was?
My father was, right.
So you grew up in that?
I grew up in that a little bit. I was so little, but I remember seeing Dorothy, whoever it was, one of them, you know, and being like 6.5 feet tall.
Right. Now, what exactly was the Hit Parade? It was a TV show?
Yeah, it was. Right. So the gag was my first words were LSMFT. Do you remember what that was?
No, no.
Lucky Strike means fine tobacco.
Oh, right. It's a little before me. It's a little before me. I'm 56.
There you go.
Yeah, right. So I know that's on the Lucky package.
That's what it is. Yeah. And so Lucky was the sponsor, right? And then they sponsored the show, at least one of the shows. And they sort of took him, but he was 25 and had 4 kids already, Second World War.
Oh my God.
Right. And the story is he went in to get a raise and they said, well, you're not worth a raise, but you can go to San Francisco.
And so he left.
And he had 4 kids. He left.
And with no plan, just 4 kids?
No, he had his step grandmother was in San Francisco.
Okay, all right. So what was the plan in San Francisco for the old man? What did he do?
He went back to BBD&O. He still did it.
Which is
Batten, Barton, Durstein, and Osborne.
Yeah.
It's Mad Men.
Okay.
It's totally Mad Men.
So it's an ad agency.
It's an ad agency, yeah.
And so that was your dad was an ad man?
He was.
And what was your mom?
A married woman.
Oh, yes. So right. The old days.
The old days. Exactly right.
So you're growing up in the Bay Area, but how old are you now?
I'm 74. What am I? 73 or 4.
So you were really the age where, you know, everything that was happening around youth culture post the 50s was, you know, relevant to you. I mean, you were part of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, a big part of my learning experience being involved with all these people was Elvis was everything to everybody.
Yeah. Oh, really?
You know,
but everything. You never shot him.
I never shot him. No, uh-huh. I mean, he was, by the time I was shooting, he was Fat Elvis, right?
Right.
And it was...
Fat, sad Elvis.
Fat, sad Elvis.
Fat, sad, and, sweaty Elvis.
And it came as a shock to me. It all came as a shock to me, but it's really true to understand any of this stuff is how much American rock and roll meant to them.
To who? The
Beatles,
the generation?
The Stones, all
for sure.
Of them,
right, yeah. I mean, yeah. And the blues, too, for the Stones.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, because it seems to me, like, after talking to... Yeah, I talked to Buddy Guy. A few weird record collectors and the Brits who learned how to play the blues really salvaged the entire musical form in the late 60s.
Yeah, true.
You know, they reintroduced it to people in a different way, and it brought people around. Like, if it weren't for the Stones and the... you know, Cream and Clapton and you know, Fleetwood Mac and stuff, you know, there's a good chance that the blues, the modern blues, would just have been, you know, derailed.
Or left where it was, which was not in front of white people.
Right, esoteric and kind of fading away once R&B came in. So, all right, so what's going on in the Bay Area? What when do you hit a certain age where you're like, I got to get involved with this shit?
Well, I'm like every kid on the planet. I mean, that's why the story's kind of interesting, which is that I loved early American rock and roll. Elvis was everything. I was in boarding school when Elvis went into
Were you when he popped on the Elvis on the Ed Sullivan show? Is that what you're talking about?
When I first saw him was that, but I think what I remember is the 45 RPM records.
Of like Hound Dog and...
Yeah, Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel and all of that stuff. And just loving it.
Right.
Playing it over and over again and my father yelling at me and all that stuff.
Really?
But really standing upstairs and trying to do my hip shake like
sure.
Elvis.
Sure, yeah,
And I got a picture of myself with a crew cut because I had the slick hair. My dad cut it all off. You know what? And I'm still not real happy about that.
You had it greased up all good?
It was what I wanted.
Pompadour?
Yeah. And he just went south one day and had everybody get haircuts.
Conservative guy?
Well, yeah. I mean, the image is my parents were Bogey and Bacall. They absolutely were when they were little at the 21 Club in New York. And then when they were older, my father died young, 60. But
oh, really?
When they were older,
cigarettes?
Cigarettes killed everybody.
Yeah.
Wow. Anybody didn't stop, pretty much gone.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and they became George and Barbara Bush.
Oh, they did.
Right? What it is. They look just like them.
That's the trajectory?
That's the trajectory.
All right. So you're listening to Elvis and it blows your mind. Now, wait. You got 3 siblings?
Yeah, 2 gone, 1 still alive.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And are you the oldest or the youngest?
Second.
Okay.
Right.
So you're off at boarding school, you're listening to Elvis, and I can't even imagine, I'm trying to think if there's any analogy to like my generation. I mean, you know, there was no big shift, no big paradigm shift in music that like woke everybody up. I mean, maybe Nirvana, but I was already in my 30s. So I don't even know what that must have felt
like.
Well,
when I was born, you know, I call the beginning of rock and roll, and I can't remember the singer, Good Rockin' Tonight.
Yeah.
Right? Elvis covered it.
Yes.
Right? But
right,
it was
right.
a black guy that yeah, right. first sang. It was 47.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, nonsense to Rock Around the Clock for me.
No, know? That's right. Yeah. They're in Bill Haley copped it. There's a bunch of them. I just read a biography of Jerry Wexler. And yeah, it was all black music.
Yeah, there
yeah.
you go.
Yeah.
And so that's, I mean, so rock and roll was 2 years old when I was born.
Right.
Right. So I think the important part to know is there's no rock and roll. There's nothing to sort of say, how's this going to happen again? Because it was happening for the first time, right?
Yeah, that's true. And the evolution made sense. The swing to the bop, to the bebop, to the, you know, the acapella groups, and then, you know, onward into a white interpretation of that stuff.
That's right.
And the country stuff, too.
But it goes away.
Yeah.
And it really does go away when Elvis goes. And then what happens, and this becomes international,
yeah.
is record companies, which had so little to do with it in the beginning, right?
Right.
Try to reinvent it. They're constantly looking for the next Elvis, you know? I mean,
oh, is that Fabian, the deal?
And that's,
oh,
what, yeah, that's right, what's yeah. going on in England. Cliff right. Richards, that's what's when I get to England,
yeah.
expect, coming out of Haight-Ashbury to do a jump, right?
Right.
I'm expecting that I'm going to get into something that's bigger and more involved than Haight-Ashbury sort of as a lifestyle, which was what was really taking over.
Was that already happening? What year are we talking?
68 when I got to England. So, yeah. So,
oh, so like,
you,
yeah.
All, yeah. All You Need Is Love is 67. I'm driving down the panhandle in Golden Gate Park.
Yeah, I used to live on the panhandle. So, like, you, but while you're in San Francisco and that, how old are you? Are you 18, 19? 67, 68?
No, older. Yeah. So that would be, so no, you're right, 18, 19, born 45.
Right. So what's happening, you feel the like, whatever Elvis was or whatever he represented was already fading fast, you know, in light of what were the acid and the hippies and everything that was starting
to
turn.
Well, yeah, I mean, Elvis and the Colonel became, you know, B movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, he took the Colonel's advice and disappeared. I mean, he almost was bigger than that. It was like a weird thing when I was a kid and yeah. I went to go see Love Me Tender
right.
as an Elvis fan.
Right.
Right. And I didn't understand who is this?
Why is he doing this?
Why is he doing it? Because I knew he was bigger than this movie, and yeah, I was 13, you know?
Right,
so
right.
It was like, it was weird, but that's what he did. And
so it sort of neutered him.
Yeah, he became irrelevant, right?
So interesting.
What happens for Americans, and it's not true that it happens for everybody, what happens for American is folk comes in.
Right.
So Baez is the first person
right.
that starts to talk to me that's music at
yeah.
all, right?
Right.
And then Dylan comes in, and,
right.
and then Dylan goes electric, and all those things happen, but they're all major, right?
Right.
And what really happens, I think, is you find that the singer-songwriter, which is blues,
yeah.
right? And to a certain extent,
country
it's
too.
Rock, but it's blues and country,
yeah.
exactly right. And that's not really in popular music.
Right.
And it comes into popular music through Dylan in large measure if you're an American, and then the Beatles are writing their own stuff and the Stones are writing their own stuff, and you know, then the whole trajectory is you got to get to groups.
Yeah, but then in the Haight you had, like, you know, Moby Grape, Blue Cheer, The Dead,
Blue
right?
Cheer, my brother managed Blue Cheer.
Did I know you got some out of nowhere there are pictures of Blue Cheer
there
in
you go yeah
because they've had sort of a resurgence. There's a whole new vinyl kind of epidemic going on,
right.
and Blue Cheer is very much revered for their kind of like raw rock sensibility.
God bless them. You know, they were really there first, and they didn't get credit for nothing.
Right, back then, right, no, yeah. Right, but right. So you were there in the Haight with your, was it your older brother?
Yeah, my older brother was the quote manager.
So right? you were kind of like running around the Haight when you were a teenager?
No, I was still in college, right? So the Haight was going on, and I was in college, and the music was coming out into college.
Where were you in college?
University of California, Davis.
Oh, in Davis. So you're kind of stranded out there in farm country.
Yeah, a little bit. But yeah. It turns out it has a great art department. Who knew?
No, yeah, I hear right. it's, yeah, they do, and they have a good, my buddy of mine teaches. He's a cultural critic and poet over there now.
Right, okay.
Josh Clover.
It's huge now.
Yeah, it's a big place, yeah. Right. But all right, so but you're tied into the Haight. Do you go see shows when you go home for
summer? A couple
times.
I was on a plane to England faster than you would have thought.
Right after college.
No, I didn't graduate.
Oh.
So there isn't really an after college. I made it to the end of my junior year.
And are you shooting in college? When do you get your first camera? Nothing?
Cameras are very late in life, right? I'm
uh-huh.
an English major. I never took a photography course.
Uh-huh.
Didn't want to be a photographer. That wasn't on my radar.
Yeah.
And started to look. There's a really famous book called Family of Man. You may know it, but it's a Edward Steichen huge
yeah.
anniversary book. And that's the first book that really reached to me, and because it was about what it says it's about, Family of Man. So
uh-huh.
it was that thing about the it was humanism, which is a large part, I think, of what happens in the sort of Beatles, Stones, early stuff is in the writing.
I don't know those photographs. I wish I did, because I know the Ansel Adams stuff was mostly naturalism.
That's correct.
And so Steichen was the humanism. I'm sure I know some of the photographs.
He edited it. It was a 50th anniversary. It was a huge Museum of Modern Art exhibit with all the major photographers.
I see. It's curated. It wasn't just him.
Exactly.
Oh, okay, great.
Right, but it was fabulous.
So that was the thing that did it, huh?
Well, kind of, and then the movie blew up.
All right, because Antonioni,
Antonioni, that's correct. Yeah. And set in London.
Yeah.
And very stylish, and that looks great.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I could have played guitar, I would have been playing guitar.
But you didn't.
But I didn't. Yeah. And it's nowhere near my skill. I can't do it. I can't tune a guitar. It took me the longest time to figure that out.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't me.
Yeah.
And that option that photography could be related to the music in a way came out of both what was happening a little bit on album covers, because that was starting to be a thing.
Yeah.
Right. And then that movie. Those two things sort of made me go, oh, well, that's cool. Maybe I should try and do that, right?
Yeah, and so you bought a camera?
I bought a camera. A Nikon, a couple lenses, right?
Yeah.
And started to take pictures. But it was all part of being this explosive time, which it truly was. And then so it's being an art major and an English major and just doing a bunch of stuff.
But you were tapped in. You realized the culture was changing. There was chaos in the streets. Vietnam was starting. The music was shifting. Like, it was really a cauldron of chaos and excitement and creativity.
Well, it totally was. And that's what the period was. Now, in England, you go to England and they don't have any war.
They don't have any war. And apparently they didn't have great acid either. Like There was the scene in England in the late 60s, based on what was going on in L.A., that they would sort of mimic it. They dressed the part of the biker, but they didn't have an indigenous biker issue in England. So a lot of the Americanized sort of archetypes and tropes of the time were basically costumes to the British. Is it true?
Spot on. Anything about England, in order to understand where they're coming from, is sort of this, the great George Harrison quote, which is when he was asked if he had a phonograph, he said, "We didn't have sugar."
Right, yeah.
And they're all kind of like coming out of a bombed out war that basically sunk the empire,
They're
broke, they don't have any money, there's nothing going on.
Right.
And everything that's going on is coming out of America.
Right.
Right. And for these guys, it's all American rock and roll.
Right, yeah.
So, but the BBC hasn't changed because of that, because it's a big government bureaucracy. So there was one DJ, a guy called John Peel, who would play a little bit.
Oh, yeah, the Peel sessions.
Yeah, you didn't hear nothing that's rock and roll. Really didn't. You might get a little sort of 3-minute promo that gets played on that. There was the...
I never put that into perspective, because when you get these BBC recordings of Bowie and stuff, these box sets that are coming out now, which are spectacular, it's all that guy Peel, I guess. It was like they didn't have much outlet.
Well, Bowie's later, Ready, Steady, Go is sort of, Michael Lindsay Hogg, who's a very interesting man and has a book called...
Yeah.
What is it? Anyway, his father's Orson Welles.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just an interesting, real American story.
And who was he?
Over there. He's a director. He directed Let It Be, right? He directed the Rock and Roll Circus.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's how I know him.
Yeah.
But he's got this kind of crazy and interesting past. He was directing Ready, Steady, Go, and Ready, Steady, Go was a live television program. The Stones would appear on it.
Right.
But it was gone by the time I got there.
Huh. Right. Late 60s, mid-60s?
Yeah. So a lot of what influenced the Brits to get involved with their own groups was sort of gone by the time I got there, which is interesting.
So who was around? What was going on when you got there?
I'm telling you, Cliff Richards.
Oh, my
God. It's so hard to imagine, but the truth of it was...
And that's 68?
Yeah. It felt like 10 years ago.
Huh.
It really did. It really felt like they were still trying to sign Elvis.
Well, so were the other bands, were the Stones out on tour? Were the Beatles, what were they doing? Where were they? Were they in hiding? I mean,
the Beatles were, of course, only about a recording.
Yeah,
right. They had
that
was all what that was. The Stones really weren't performing because of the problems with Brian Jones and drug busts and all the rest
taxes,
of that.
Right,
and taxes and all of that was really shutting people down. Right.
All right. So you show up with your camera. Now, did you learn how to process and print and everything?
Let me see about that. Process, yes. Print, kinda.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got there, what I found in the great tradition of Britain was that there are people that really know how to do that.
To print.
And process.
And process, right? Yeah.
So I was like, you guys take this. You're much better at than I am. So I knew that. That was about it.
You're dropping the film off.
I'm dropping the film off and coming back and it looks good.
Yeah. Hey, this is great. Give me a few of these.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
But that makes it easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. Right. You're not inhaling chemicals or spending half your life in the dark room.
Exactly right.
All right. So how do you break into shooting these guys?
Total. So the story's, so I want to be a writer. So if you back this up just a tiny bit, I wanted to be a writer and then in college couldn't deal with it.
Like what? Poetry? Yeah, short stories?
But I didn't know nothing.
Yeah,
so
I get
it's like
it.
It's like
that's
it's
an
like
English major. We don't know anything.
That's exactly right.
We know a little bit about a lot of things.
Nothing, right? Nothing. Yeah. Can barely read, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't know why I think I'm going to be able to write. But that's the best I can do because something's got to come out of your mouth when it says, "What do you want to be?"
Sure,
right?
Yeah, writer. So you show up with your notebook and your camera.
Yeah. But I really can't tell you how little I know. Nothing. Right?
Yeah.
But that's kind of what I'm thinking of doing. When I get to England, what happens is it feels good.
Yeah.
Right. Feels like I've been there. Still feels that way. London in particular. Right?
Yeah, really? Do you have a genetic connection to it?
Don't know what it was. Had an English nanny. That was part of my past. And
yeah, because I feel that about Ireland, but I have no connection genetically.
I know. I've been
Ireland.
Reading about that. Ireland's fabulous.
Best.
Yeah, really.
So fucking beautiful.
Yeah,
heavy-hearted and gorgeous. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So you feel that in England.
I felt that right away. Now, really, the Parks. So the Parks had a kind of blow-up connection because that's so much a blow-up, right?
Right. That's where the murder was, right?
I never found that park. I looked, walked all over England looking for that park. It's pre-Google.
Yeah.
Right now, you find, okay, there it is.
Can you research it? Did you figure out which park it was?
I never found out until Google.
But now you know.
No, but I've never been still.
Oh, okay.
Right? It's almost enough to go back just for that.
Yeah, you should. Get closure.
Right, exactly. So I love that. But the music wasn't there, right? So the photography was kind of like, I had some cameras here and sometimes I'd take a walk. And
it seems like the early stuff is just sort of like you doing, kind of Robert Frank work.
Yeah, I wish there were more.
Or the Bresson, kind of thing.
But I was too, Bresson was an influence. I met Frank on
when
the 72 tour.
When he was shooting Cocksucker Blues?
I didn't know he was.
Oh, really?
What a pathetic statement.
Well, those his was The Americans, right?
That's right, The Americans.
It's a great series. Yeah.
Classic. Unbelievable.
But Bresson,
Bresson was it. Bresson, English photographer, kind of obscure, called Bill Brandt, was an influence.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And then everything black and white, everything that was England, it's like Taste of Honey, the movie, remember that?
Yeah.
And sort of The Knack, not really, but kind of, and Hard Day's Night, of course.
Right? Yeah.
All of that sort of gritty black and white America, which Quadrophenia's got a lot of that in it.
Well, you shot that, right?
Yeah.
All those pictures from Quadrophenia, you were on set. You were a set photographer?
No. All that whole book we created.
Okay.
There was no movie.
Oh, there wasn't a movie.
It was ahead of the movie.
That's right, yeah.
So the art sort of trajectory is at some point after I've been doing it for a while, and now I'm Beatles, Stones, and Who, and so it's kind of like, well, can't stop now, right?
Well, I mean, but how do you get there? Like, so you're shooting around, you're shooting, women you have a crush on, you're shooting people in the street.
Hardly. What I'm really trying to do is write, right?
And what are you writing?
Bad little short poems. It's horrible. It's horrible. Right?
Who are you showing those to?
Well, this guy comes by. So this is the story. So a college friend comes over comes to England. A lot of Americans did that.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
And then he says you should meet this guy, Jonathan Cott. Jonathan Cott was, it turns out, to be a stringer on a magazine which was brand new called Rolling Stone. Right.
Right.
But I'm not thinking about pictures. I'm not thinking about any of it anymore. And John sees the pictures I have of Blue Cheer. That's the trigger.
That you shot like hanging out with your brother.
Yeah.
Right.
And when he leaves, he asks me if I want to photograph his next interview. And I said, sure, who? And he goes, Mick Jagger.
Those are the Rolling Stones pictures, 68, rugby shirt.
My first session.
The rugby shirt.
That's correct.
I remember those pictures, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like, and I really thought, I don't know what else to say, except you have to believe me, this was so unlikely that I never expected it to happen again, right?
So you go and you show up, so he's interviewing Mick. I guess was that the first Rolling Stone interview?
That's correct.
And you're just a fly in the wall kind of deal. He did, the guy's talking. Go, this is is Ethan?
Yeah.
He's going to be doing the thing.
Yeah, and fly in the wall was everything that makes sense to me.
Yeah,
right. So the thing when I had to finally think, I got to explain how I take pictures at some point. Somebody's going to ask me.
Right.
And it happened for me as a vision, which was of myself as a young guy. And I wish I knew if I had slick back hair, because it'd be better if I did. Yeah. Right. And I'm hunting. My grandmother's got a big ranch in Carmel Valley. Right.
Yeah.
And she wants me to shoot blue jays for some obscure reason. And that seems fine to me. We had a little gun, a little tiny 22.
Yeah.
And so it's this part I think is easy to imagine. Imagine that that's what you're doing, right? So how can you do that? You got to come, you got to go to where they are.
Right.
You got to be real quiet.
Yeah.
Right. You got to, and you got to stand really still.
Yeah.
And then if they show up, you got to do like, you got 1 or 2 seconds and you got to get it. And that's what you do. And that's how I took pictures.
Right.
Totally. That's the thing that did it. And I could frame. Those were the two pieces.
Framing's an innate thing.
Framing is a gimme, like being able to tune a guitar, I swear, you know.
Sure.
It's a gimme, right? Yeah. And but it always mattered to me, and I was
it's great.
You know, and I was always good at it.
But it's like, either you have it or you don't.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, well, why'd you want the Blue Jays dead? I mean, I've heard that before. I can't remember. They're predatory. They eat something.
Well, they're nasty,
they fuck up something?
Well, she's a big horticulturist. That's what she cared about.
Right, yeah.
And they would drop shit on plants that she was trying to grow, and, you know, it seems a little extreme, frankly. In retrospect, but at the time, I didn't even think about it.
So, you heartless bastard.
Yeah, there you go. I said it. I was in Toronto, and they were like, what Blue Jays, the baseball team?
Yeah, he's out killing athletes.
Yeah, there you go.
So, okay, so you shoot Mick, and you thought that was a one-off?
I totally did.
But
I thought I was cool. You got to understand.
You were definitely cool. I mean, so you had no real interaction, but you heard everything, right? Did you have an interaction with Mick?
No, hello. I mean, that's sort of the way I felt about it. I never made any sense to me, why would they want an interaction with me, and where would it be my place to want an interaction with them? It took years.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the question of the photographer, and also, I mean, until you're doing, I guess, actual photo shoots, which even then it's limited, but there has to be some sort of relationship between you and them, or them and the camera that you're holding.
Once the camera goes on a tripod, right, you got to bring them to the camera.
Uh-huh.
Right.
That's the way that goes.
And then that becomes more directorial.
Right.
And there are certain people really good at it. I always found it incredibly sort of nervous inducing, because so much pressure's on you. Right?
Yeah.
But you know, they're greats at it, like Avedon. I mean, they're just brilliant, and they can create that.
I don't know how he did, but he did some. I don't know, like the American West book. You know,
it's unbelievable.
But what, do you have a truck or something?
No, he did. One of the few books I know that's a book about the making of a photograph.
Right,
there are very few.
Yeah,
right? And he shot that. It was a commission.
American West.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, Dallas Museum or something like that, right?
Yeah.
He shot 8x10 film camera, and he did it in open shade. So there's pictures of him shooting.
So the negatives are 8x10?
Then he shot nothing but 8x10.
That's almost. Huge camera.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's a real Ansel Adams camera.
Yeah.
So to use that as your tool for that kind of photography is a big deal.
So, but how do you do the white background?
Took the white background with him.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
What a book that is.
Yeah. It's my favorite. Really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you look at it, it's just like every one of the people, it's like a history of brutality and sadness and hard life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of interesting, like Arbus-like in a funny way.
And no, it definitely is. There's definitely, but you know, unlike Arbus, he sort of lets the subject, you know, whatever his magic is in capturing it in the sort of sparing way that he did, it's all about whatever is happening in that person. Whereas, you know, you felt that Arbus was actually in the life of the person.
Yeah, I mean, she had an agenda.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't think he had an agenda.
So, but you're doing, so you do the Mick Jagger shoot and you're like, that was amazing. You get paid?
Yeah, maybe.
But so how did, and then what happens is
and then I'm going back to my, so at that point I was working, because I was in England, I was lucky to be there.
Yeah.
And I was working in a hospital with autistic children, which is something that mattered to me.
Yeah.
Right. And I felt was great. Right.
What were you doing with them?
I had a child that I in particular looked after.
Oh, okay.
Right? So it was really like that. I had, first of all, read about autism in Life
magazine.
You
wanted to do something good.
I felt like that was appropriate. Yeah. I was lucky. Guy, and I didn't want to sit around and not write, you know, or write badly or whatever it was.
You want to give back a little bit.
You know, I wanted to give it back a little bit. And so I was doing that when this came up, and I went back to doing that. you know? Uh-huh. And like 3 months later, John Cott, same guy, calls me again and says, do you want to shoot my next interview?
Yeah.
And I said, who is it? And he said, John Lennon. So, you know, more luck than any human should be allowed to have. And those were my first two. And by then I'm going, well, that, you know. And I think the fact that I was an American really, really helped me. Right?
Yeah, why?
Because they liked Americans, right?
Right?
And
sure.
Also, culturally, you can't spot people that are outside of your culture
right.
as easily as you can your own, right?
Yeah.
So I was A, American, B, kind of connected with Rolling Stone, C, and took a different kind of picture, honestly. Yeah. The kind of picture where you're not bothering them and you're not getting them to stand up, where you're really taking a picture of their world,
right?
Right, and then showing it back to them. I think that had a huge, I know it had a lot to do with Let It Be, because
uh-huh.
that's exactly what happened. I had, long story, 3 days at the end of the day after Neil Aspinall jerked me around. And
Neil who?
Neil Aspinall, who's the head of Apple
yeah.
Records and had been with them since Driving Vans.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
And after Brian Epstein died, a big part of their story,
yeah.
He had took that chair.
Yeah.
Right. And so I asked him, he called me. He
yeah.
called me because I had pictures of John.
Right.
Right.
So, from the Rolling Stone interview?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And some, or maybe just those, because I don't know if I had the John and Yoko stuff yet. And I went in to see him, and as he's looking at them, I also had the Rock and Roll circus pictures.
You already shot those of Mick and Taj and Eric.
Yeah, all
and
that all like that. 2 weeks before.
So the Rock and Roll Circus on set stuff. You know who pulled you in for that? Your buddy, the
yeah.
Orson
now
Welles
I knew everybody.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So Michael was one, and yeah. I also knew I was friends with then known as Joe Bergman, who was running the Stones office. Right?
Yeah,
I became friends with the people that were around them. A lot of them were Americans.
Yeah,
right, and so. It was just kind of natural and easy. It was a very small world.
But that Rock and Roll Circus thing, it's really even hard to find, you know, the footage of that stuff. What was the idea of that show? I mean, how many were there?
No, so how many shows? It wasn't a real show. It was shot for television.
Right, that's what I mean. Right, so but there was only a couple of them. Was it one episode or the Rock and Roll Circus? Was it a series?
It's channeling Ed Sullivan is what it was,
yeah.
right? And it was because they couldn't tour,
yeah.
right? Couldn't go outside. They had to do something.
So
right?
it was a Rolling Stones produced event?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so it was filmed, I think, just to get something out there because
yeah.
they couldn't tour and they couldn't do anything. And if you really delve into it, it's interesting because it's very much, you know, Jagger's an entertainer, which you didn't necessarily know then,
yeah.
right?
Right.
He was Mick Jagger,
right.
right? And he was also flirting around with Mick Jagger and the devil and all that nonsense,
yeah.
bad guy, all
yeah.
the rest of that. But really the core being in, or at least part of it, is the entertainer, right?
Yeah.
So he knows what an entertainment is. They had this problem and they decided to do this show. Oh, that's yeah. what that was all
just
about.
Just invite people and do some, you know.
No, and without much money, because they didn't have hardly any money, really.
Right.
And so that's what it was.
Huh.
And it was, there's a really interesting part about it, which I think talks a lot to something, which
yeah.
is that those images today look pathetic, right? I think it's
do they?
Well, kind of.
I guess it depends how much you love those people.
Yeah, you love them, but the thing that's really interesting is all the music was live.
Right. Well, no, but I mean, like, right. I don't think they look like. Did you? Isn't there one with like Keith and an eye patch? I didn't see it in this book, but I remember seeing one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
like, you know, and there's this whole circus environment, but you see Eric Clapton and Taj Mahal and all these people there. When I look at it, I still sort of like, that must have been great.
That was just, great. That was.
I never think like this is ridiculous.
No, it's more the but as a visual person.
Oh yeah.
Right, and as a filmmaker, which I wasn't really yet.
Right.
But you know,
sure.
The expectations. There's not about. It's not about that.
Yeah.
That's kind of almost a throwaway.
Right.
Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. Okay, well, what do you get when you say that?
Yeah.
You get a clown juggler and a knife thrower.
Right,
all,
yeah, yeah.
You know. And so they did all that stuff, but really it was a way to just package and showcase those people, which they did.
Yeah. So, okay, so I know it's a sidebar, but we're moving towards the Let It Be shoot, but like how, so you show up with this guy, the guy at Apple, and what, he gives you the runaround?
He saw, I sort of think, you know, I show him the, because I'm not an idiot, right? Yeah. I figure I'm going into Apple, I'll take these pictures, right?
Of John, yeah.
John and the Rock and Roll Circus,
yeah.
Right? And those guys are constantly looking over the shoulder at each other. What are they doing? What are they doing?
The Stones and the Beatles. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I show it. I don't know what's going on with it. And I ask him, though, because I have no business doing any of this. That's very clear to me, right?
You should be writing poems.
Yeah, I should be writing poems. Right? Bad poems. Boy, that would there you go. They were short anyway, so...
I'm glad you didn't put any in the book.
You know, thank God. If I could find anything, I'd burn them. So I said, I thought I'd just ask.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just ask. So I said, can I go down? You know, I want to shoot the Beatles. Can I do that?
Yeah. Right?
And he said, absolutely not. You know,
yeah.
And truly, I thought that's the most sensible thing that's been said to me. That made sense to me. But I knew everybody, so I knew where they were.
Yeah.
So I got in the car and I just drove down.
To where the roof?
To Twickenham sound stages, where they started.
You know?
So if you remember the movie at all, it's being recut by Peter Jackson. You know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't see them. I mean, was it a full-length movie?
Yeah, it was, but it was kind of got buried. It was a documentary.
Yeah.
You know,
I've seen parts of it, but I don't know that I've seen the whole thing. When I was in high school, it was around.
I think it was kind of buried.
Yeah,
because it came out and a lot was going on when it was released because Alan Klein had just come in.
Yeah.
Right. That album, which was done before Abbey Road, took forever to come around, and it was just all of that.
And then Phil Spector came in,
and that's all Alan Klein. And you know, whatever you feel about Paul McCartney, you got to go. It's like what.
Yeah.
You know, you're bringing in what?
Well, then they release, but you know, it's weird. Even with Spector, it's something that, and I'm sure this is all within the lore. But you know, they certainly neutered Spector a great deal. You don't listen to that record and feel Spector's presence really.
Yeah, a little bit, not much.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit of Starfucker, really. Honestly,
I guess so.
Klein's bringing in the big American producer.
Yeah,
but Let It Be, Glyn Johns was the engineer slash sort of producer in the sense that he was behind the keyboards, and there was nobody else there talking about that. George Martin was hardly ever around.
For that album?
Yeah, never saw him.
Yeah.
And so it was a real aberration start to finish.
It sounds different.
Yeah.
It sounds different than
everything about it's different. I mean, so put your brain around the fact that this is the biggest act in the world. I don't know who's that big today, if anybody, but you know, and somebody comes up with an idea that they'll show up on a sound stage in January and make a record.
Yeah. So you go down there.
I go down there, and I'm sort of sitting in a corner with, you know, and it's also seeing...
And you get in because you know guys, and you shot John.
Nobody's at the door saying you can't come in. It's a different time, man. And so I just sort of sneak in, and I'm standing in sort of the back of this big soundstage, and I'm watching them, and they're small at the end, and, you know, they look like the Beatles because there's a riser for the drums and all the rest of that.
Yeah.
And then I look over, and it's Neil.
Yeah.
And he's looking at me, and I think, oh, fuck.
You know, now busted.
Now what?
Yeah.
And he walks up to me and says, we've decided to let you come down.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That was diplomatic for me to say that. You're already in.
Yeah, it's almost, it's you know, East End.
Right.
You know. But, and then he only would give me, he said, for one day. And I said, not for one day, 3 days.
Yeah.
Why? Because I may not get anything in one day.
Right.
And then when I took those pictures into Apple Records.
The ones in the studio.
The ones in the film studio.
Right.
Right. And they were beautiful. Tony Richmond, who was the lighting cameraman, had these big pools of light. They were pretty.
Yeah.
Right? And I went up in the rafters and I did all this and I was showing them and it was only supposed to be Derek Taylor, who was the press officer. And then everybody showed up. Paul was there. Linda was there. John was there. Yoko was there. Billy Preston was there. Everybody was there.
Was this before Linda was shooting?
Yeah, Linda sort of was. We were going to. There was a thing called the Get Back book, which is 140 pages, came out with the album on every country except America, right? And they were all my pictures.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And Linda was supposed to be part of it and then dropped out.
Oh, because I like the pictures that you have in your book, and like, I remember looking at them obsessively. I mean, there are you shot the cover of the record.
And
all the rooftop shots.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing some of those studio pictures. I don't know where, but I remember looking at them intensely. Did they come with the record? Were they inside the liner?
The record in America was a double. It was a gatefold.
They were in there.
American parlance. Right.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But the book, which is really pretty great, The Get Back book, it may be called Let It Be, was 120 pages, all my pictures.
I must have seen that. Yeah. So now, but at that point, do you start? when you're shooting for 3 days and you're obviously, you know, right there with them, do you start to build a relationship with the Beatles?
No, I never would have. Well, so first of all, you have to realize they're being filmed.
Yeah.
Okay, they're being filmed and they're making a record.
Right.
More to the point, though, is why would they talk to me? John always did. I was always like friends with John, partly because that's how we met.
Yeah.
Partly, I really believe now because I took really good pictures of his girlfriend.
Yeah.
I mean, I think
of Yoko.
Yeah, of Yoko. I didn't know who she was, and it was early on.
And he liked him.
And he, bam, I showed up and took them out of my hands, put them on the wall.
Yeah.
Like, bam.
Yeah,
right,
here you go.
Know? And we got on, and we really did. I was friends
with
John.
Nice guy.
Yeah, I thought he was fabulous.
So, all right, so now, was it a heavy day shooting the Beatles' last session? They knew they were done?
Well, how entirely did they know that they were done? You know, they were done.
They were done.
Right, but I don't think anybody was quite saying it yet. So it hadn't been announced yet.
But did you feel a vibe?
Oh, it was terrible.
It was?
Right. Well, it was also, it was supposed to be, initially it was going to be a session in a photo studio. So yeah. I had spent the week before thinking about that.
Yeah.
And then the night before I got, don't do that, come to John. So I got no ideas, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't really do photo sessions.
Right.
You know, you put your finger right on it. That's a really, I think it's really abstract. What's a photo session?
Right.
You know, and that's what people still do.
Yeah,
say.
Sure.
So
they do them
what is it to have
your
picture?
They usually take you into an environment that you're not comfortable with. Sometimes there's clothes involved.
Yeah.
And some, you know, then the photographer's doing everything to get you to kind of have a dynamic with him and the camera if he's not feeling it. They'll put music on. It's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's very, very false.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And so therefore, it's not my cup of meat. And also now they had a second photographer from the Daily Mail come. That was Neil's idea, which was fine with me. But now I'm supposed to be telling them what to do. I don't tell people what to do.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Townsend used to rip me a new one all over the place. Say,
right.
Tell us what to do. Tell us what to do. Right. It really made him angry. And it's interesting that sometimes when you don't tell people what to do, you get something that they bring to the table that they don't
frustrated.
Know.
Because they're frustrated.
They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get stuff you wouldn't otherwise get, you know.
But the vibe on that day
was horrible.
In what way?
Well, I think that if you took, I don't know what.
Because I love that picture. I love that record. I know it's a bits and pieces of a lot of different things, the Hey Jude record, but like it was one of the first Beatles records. You know, that one, Let It Be, in the second album, for some reason, the ones I had when I was a kid. And I love Let It Be. I love Hey Jude. I love that record.
Right. I don't think of that. When I think of that session, I don't think of that picture.
Right.
Right. I think of the black and white pictures that are in the book.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that's what they were doing. I mean, I shot very little color. Right.
Right.
And they didn't have anything else, so that's what they used.
Right.
Of the black and white, which is, let's say I shot 8 rolls or 10 rolls, something like that. I don't think George changed his expression the whole day.
Sad.
He's pissed off.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Over. Everything about him says over.
Right.
Just everything.
Do you know why?
I think it was over.
They were going different directions.
Yeah, I just think that there wasn't anything there anymore. I'm speculating, but I think the big deal was that Brian Epstein was gone. And, you know, Brian was the one that said, you get up and you go here and do what you're supposed to do, and then we'll tell you where to go next. And while that was shifting, obviously, it was still, I think, fundamentally the case. And when he's gone, nobody can do that.
That brain tumor?
I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know the exact answer. I think it was sort of, you know, what's the fancy word for downer? You know, I think it was a downer, and alcohol is what I think, right? And then so Paul kind of, it's his nature. Paul kind of leapt into that.
Yeah.
You have siblings?
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, your siblings got a great idea for you.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah,
and he really means it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't care what you have for me.
It just seemed like there was something kind of ripping at, you know, outside of Ringo, that, you know, the sort of creative ambitions of each of them was very different. And they, you know, and I guess the what was holding them together was breaking.
I think they were done. I think Yoko certainly didn't break them up. I mean,
no,
I think that's
no, no.
Been
that's very clear about that. You kind of feel that in the documentary.
I think I did a thing. So I have the pictures in the book of John and Yoko falling in love, and they're some of my favorite pictures. They're just so intimate and lovely, and you know, you really feel it. You know, you feel his love for her, and you can really see it.
Yeah,
and you can see a real tenderness coming from her. It's sweet.
It seemed like she really opened him up.
Yeah, it was different. So I did a couple of years ago, I did a Valentine's Day show where those pictures were the core of it.
Yeah.
And in order to try and make something of an evening about it, I did a little research, right? And what you realize is that both of them are war babies, her even more than him.
Big time. Her family was a wealthy family in Japan that had, kind of lost everything, I think.
Lost everything, had to take the suitcase and walk out of town.
Yeah.
Right? And so they shared that, and she, I think, had it as a motivator more than him, because I think it was bigger for her, and she was older when it happened. And so she was always sort of, that was present for her, and she, I think, imagine doesn't happen if he doesn't marry Yoko.
Oh, no, definitely not. Right. It seems like a lot of her sort of creative sensibility, the simplicity of it and the poetry of it and the weird kind of artistic courage of it really had an impact on him.
Totally.
Like the language of the songs, I think, is Yoko.
That's right.
Okay, so once you do that cover, now you're a guy that does sessions. So how does, The Who's Next cover. I want to talk about the Who's Next cover. So, whose idea was that?
You can't have that idea.
What?
It wasn't an idea.
No, of course not.
Right? It was something.
How did you get out to that place? Where the fuck was that shot?
That was shot at Islington Colliery. I have no idea.
And you got hired to do that.
Yeah, I was hired because by that point, after Let It Be becomes Rolling Stones' 69 tour, that's really what happens next. And then, Who's Next is like 71.
So the 69 tour, okay, is that where you shot? When did you shoot Brian? Right before that?
Right before. Brian died in the summer of 69.
69?
Right 3 days before. I mean, like July 1st or something. 3 days before the concert in the park.
Because they have to eulogize him. And
that's
right. Still fucking warm almost.
Yeah.
And, and Mick's wearing that weird dress shirt.
That to me, that tells you so much if you're in your English hoop putting on costume stuff.
Yeah.
They got the Hells Angels, the fake Hells Angels down below. Yeah. Right? They got Jagger wearing an Edwardian smock.
Yeah.
They've got these moths that they're pretending are butterflies, right? They got a black man with makeup on him wearing it like reeds carrying a spear that's running across. It's culturally psychotic.
You shot all that.
I shot some of it. Somebody tried to spike Jagger for that concert.
Yeah.
Give him a load of brownies.
Right?
And it never even occurred to me that they'd be spiked, right?
Yeah.
So I said, sure, I'll have.
So you were out of commission?
I'm just like, well, first of all, they put me up on there. You can't move. Yeah. I did not do a good job. Right. No.
How did that Brian Jones shoot come about? Because I knew those pictures as well.
Well, Brian was just like, it was the end of a series of individuals. This is when I really got to know the Stones a little bit, because I shot them all individually for this magazine that went bust before.
In 67?
68. Early 69. Yeah. So that's 69 with Brian.
Yeah.
And so I go down to his house. He bought A.A. Milne's house. It's so sort of sad and charming.
The Winnie the Pooh guy?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, the pictures in there, he's choking Christopher Robin, which since he looked just like Christopher Robin, right? So it was, he showed up and he did all that. He went upstairs. I was just taking pictures of him.
Was he wasted?
He was wasted, hungover, wasted, probably. Oh, there's a close-up not in the book of him, and he looks 46.
Yeah.
I didn't see it. I'm thinking this is really bitching.
Yeah,
look at this. Look what he's doing. This is so cool.
With the flag and the gun
and
the shirt.
Oh, my God. Rolling Stones stuff. I mean, sort of, if Honky Tonk Woman is like that, Rolling Stones sort of, one of my favorite things is the 45 cover where they're dressed up like, wax and waves.
I love that
stuff.
You didn't shoot that, though, did you?
I should know, but I don't.
The Honky Tonk Women, they're like, there's a sailor.
It's the same idea.
But that's later, right?
It's later. That's correct. And but it's me trying to live up to my predecessors.
Sure.
Right?
So Brian was a nice guy?
I found him nice, but because much older now, I've read about some of this stuff. He was nice to me. The way it was. But he was pretty crazed and a mess. The picture where he looks 46, you can tell that his liver's shot because his belly's all out. Yeah. So, and there wasn't, nobody was... knew about that.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't like later,
wasted he was?
Nobody knew that he was on his way out.
Oh.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Right? Because people weren't on their way out yet. He was the first, right? Of that crowd.
Yeah.
Right? And then all of a sudden they're all gone.
Yeah.
Right? And all for the same reason, more or less. Right? So, But I didn't know that. It didn't occur to me at all.
And that was sort of the last pictures.
They were the last pictures, to my knowledge, yeah.
So then you do the 69 tour with the Stones?
Same thing. So you can tell how my business plan was mapped out.
Right.
So I hear the Stones are in L.A., so I just drive down. I'm in San Francisco. I just get down, and I walk into the house. They got two houses. It's a totally big deal of the whole thing. They got to do this tour. You know, they got Mick Taylor with them, so they can tour for the first time. It's not successful, no mas Rolling Stones, you know.
Well, there was a conscious effort that Mick was going to align himself with the new psychedelic generation, you know, in order to sort of, you know, get the Stones up to speed culturally in America. So they were going to have their Woodstock, and they aligned themselves with the Dead and their people. Everything just kind of broke apart. There was all these weirdos, you know, traveling with the Stones, and they didn't even know who they were.
I was one of them.
But like, apparently there were guys on the payroll. They're like, what is that guy doing? Who's the guy with the cars? Who's the guy showing up with the limos? Like, there was...
Oh, well, he was something. So I did that whole tour with them. I wasn't just at Altamont. I did the... There were 16 people on the 69 tour.
But was Altamont the last date?
Last gig. Yes.
Okay, well...
Added.
Right, but the original intention was to do a big festival type of show.
Oh, yeah, no question about it.
And then, like, everything fell apart, and they found that fucking horrible speedway in the middle of nowhere, right?
So they had...
I'm telling you the story.
I know the story well. I wrote a book on it.
You did?
Yeah. It's all from the inside, if you will, because I was with the Stones, right? Talk about writing.
Yeah.
I finally wrote.
Yeah.
Right? I've written four books now, I think, three books, something like that. And that book took 6 years, and I
Let It Bleed, it's called?
Yeah. I'll get it to you.
When did you write that?
I wrote it. I think it came out in 2005.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the tour was amazing, but you're right about this. From the minute Jagger got off the plane, and Richards, all of them, it was like you're going to do a free concert because Woodstock was everybody's, it was the template, right?
And
are you guys going to do it? And so they didn't say they were going to do it, although they had the... north of San Francisco, the Speedway, not Altamont, the other one. And they lost that at last minute. So that what you see in the Maisels movie is 3 days before the concert, they're announcing, the guy from, you know, Dick Carter shows up.
Yeah.
I'm told later, I didn't know this because it sounds so perfect, he was taking a marketing course at Stanford. He was an old guy.
Yeah.
By those standards, those days. And some kid said, you know, the Rolling Stones are looking for a place. So a marketing guy, at Stanford, he shows up at Mel Bellock's office and says, I got the place. He didn't have nothing was organized.
Right.
But I think the mindset matters. And the mindset of the 60s was, we're just going to do it.
Right.
And it's going to be better than the last time because everything was.
Right.
So they thought they'd bring it off. It was horrible.
Yeah, but I mean, like, it just seemed... Now, was the 69 tour, was that where you took that, like, the fucking... Is seminal the right word? The Patience Please, A Drug for Your America Comes First shot of Keith?
72.
That was 72.
Yeah.
Now, you posed him for that.
I did. And I seldom pose stuff. And I thought, but it was, there it was right in front of me.
You got to
do it.
All right, so wait, let's go back to Altamont, because part of this is... We're kind of putting this up the day before the 50th anniversary. So, so what I gleaned from the book was that, because you were there, right? You were backstage, whatever that meant.
There was no stage to be back of.
It was like 3 feet off the ground. And
well, it was the same stage that had been the tour, the whole tour. That had been the height of that. So you're getting this book for sure. The height of that stage was the same for the whole tour. You can see pictures from Oakland. You can see pictures all over the place.
Yeah.
And people are on the stage like this.
Just like with their elbows on the stage. So there's no moat.
There's no nothing.
Uh-huh.
No.
And from what I understand, the Angels were there just for show and for free beer and for a party, but there was infighting with the Angels to a degree because they had different clubs were up there and there were some younger recruits trying to make their bones.
I think that's completely right. My main source for a lot of that is Sam Cutler, who was right there. I mean, Sam went to work for the Dead afterwards, worked for them for quite a long time, right?
But the Dead, like by the time the thing went down, they had kind of pulled away from it, right?
Cutler's quote is the greatest act of moral cowardice.
was the Dead?
They just decided they weren't. They heard that you can see it in the the movie, Maisel's movies. Yeah. They're basically, they're up on the, they're, if I read it right, I think they're up where the helicopters are landing, which is a racetrack above.
And they were like bad vibes
around. And somebody said they knocked Marty Balin out on stage. I mean, there's the moment. You know, that's where the Philosopher Kings, that's where all of that hierarchy, which had been established in the last 5 years, was just knocked on its ass. You know, they knocked out a singer, a songwriter.
The Angels did.
They did on stage, right? Now, yeah, I got the same read you do, which is that, you know, the whole Hell's Angels in the park.
Yeah.
There's lots of depth to this stuff. Yeah. The whole Hell's Angels in the park was really coming out of Ken Kesey and out of that La Honda movement that moved into Golden Gate Park. It was true for the BN and early on. It was what it was. And they kind of did that. They kind of wandered around.
The Angels did.
Yeah. And the thing was is that Jagger's looking from across the way.
So they were integrated into, you know, the counterculture as sort of like... you know, a darker element, but they helped define it.
We're all freaks together, man.
Right, and Hunter's book, you know, talks a lot of. I think that some of that takes place up at Kesey's place.
Yeah, that's right. That's just down the coast. I mean, you know, it's 35 miles south or something.
Right, right. And he was sort of embracing the Angels, the original crew.
That's right. I mean, that was. I think that was part of the opening up, which happened. And then, you know, when you're smoking, when you're smoking dope and you're dropping acid, you're an outlaw.
Yeah, right.
So everybody got to be on the outlaw side of the fence.
Right, right? But I guess the real issue, what sort of came to a head at Altamont, is that you know the Hell's Angels were real outlaws. They weren't just druggies. They were moving shit and dropping dudes.
Yeah, they were, and they were from all over the state.
Yeah.
So, and you got, and I think this is, you know, there's Hell's Angels and there's Mick Jagger, and they're both paying homage to the devil, but one's in show business.
Yeah.
And he's English.
And the other one's actually working for the devil.
Yeah, and they're really, and I interviewed Bill Wyman from that book when I was doing it, and Bill was like, I don't know what happened. You know, he says only the Rolling Stones had only been scared twice, maybe.
Well, they like, from what you were there, so tell me, I mean, like, because even in those pictures, and you can see in the movie, and the thing about the movie that I didn't realize is that initially the Maisel brothers were going to create, they wanted to shoot a tour in a sort of like a celebration of the Stones way, that the original intent was we're going to capture this great rock band doing a great tour, and then it became this fucking thing.
Well, they didn't do the whole tour, for starters. They showed up at the end of the tour, maybe a week before the end, and I think the idea was at that point to get some B-roll, if you will,
right,
but that they were really going to shoot, they'd have a live concert. So they shot Madison Square Garden twice, right?
Right.
And then this got added. So the Jagger announced this on the 26th of my birthday, so I remember Jagger announced it on the 26th of November at Rockefeller, you know, Rainbow Room.
Right.
And that's when it kind of the word got out. Right?
So when you get there, I mean, do you realize that that like, hey, there's no fucking medical tent, there's no bathrooms?
Well, I got there. So everybody, with the exception of Keith, who I think spent the night out there, right? Everybody came in by helicopter.
What do you mean he spent the night out there? In a trailer?
No, I think, God knows. Everybody, Stanley Booth's book's the best book on this.
Stanley what?
Stanley Booth.
Okay.
He was on the whole tour.
Yeah.
Right? And his book is very sort of modeled on Moby Dick, sort of, you know, truly, it's sort of like the alternate chapters like Grapes of Wrath.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Dance with the Devil.
Okay.
Okay. It's not the Altamont story, but it's a totally deep story, and it has a lot to do
about
with
the
Brian.
Tour?
Well, no, and Brian died.
Okay, all right.
He comes over to England, and he's really involved with Brian. He's from Memphis. He's got a lot of chops.
Right? Yeah.
So some of this I know because he was with him.
Right.
Right. And Jagger was with him. Jagger and Keith were at Altamont the night before.
Okay.
Keith decides to stay.
Yeah.
Jagger says, "I would stay, but I got to sing."
Yeah.
Right. So he goes back to the hotel. But at that point, and everybody that you talk to will tell you that the scene was really mellow, you know.
Where, at so, the beginning?
At the night before.
Oh.
And that the expectation.
Wait, when they were building the stage and
shit? Oh, no, people were already showing up.
Oh. Oh, really?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
There people on,
camping,
you know,
out and shit.
Campfires and shit like that, you know. And so the expectation, which was my expectation too, my expectation was Woodstock West. It just was.
Yeah, Americans, it's going to be groovy.
It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Right? And I didn't really, took me a, you know, it was, it's a shitty spot.
Yeah.
You know, no control. Pictures in the book, you'll see the helicopters landing, there are people walking across where the helicopters and dogs are there. Yeah. There's nothing. It's nothing.
No security.
Right. Everybody was scrambling with the expectation you'd bring it off.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
and you don't give up.
Right.
You know, you just do it. So, but it took me a while to just, the vibe was weird. There wasn't a tree in sight. It was great. I grew up in San Francisco. I never heard of Altamont.
Yeah. Right? It looked like a fucking nuclear wasteland.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And so I go back to the tent. That's all there is this tent behind the stage. And, you know, there's real Hell's Angels. I'm a Californian. I know what a Hell's Angel looks like, you know. I mean, like I said, when Bill, I was interviewing Bill, he was like, well, I don't understand. They were fine in London. And, you know, they were 14. Some of them were wearing wigs.
It was a costume party.
It was a costume party. So it's that divide, which you nailed earlier, is so behind all this, right? And so when I got there, there were real Hell's Angels in there. I took a picture. I had flash. I hardly ever used flash, but you could, there was no light, right? And so, and somebody, I took flash, and then three Hell's Angels look at me like that, and I thought, I'm done.
Right.
And I can really sympathize with what I think is essentially what their feeling is, which is, hey, man, you know, this is the 30th show or the 20th show, and if it's not the 20th show of this tour, it's the 400th show we've done since we've been doing this.
Yeah.
You know, it's a gig.
Yeah, right.
You know, the Washington Post just did a huge thing on Altamont, really very good. And they talked to everybody. They talked to Graham, and they talked to David Crosby. And they really put a perspective on it that I didn't have because mine was on the inside.
Outside of like the general lack of safety and the chaos and the there's no bathroom. People are there all fucking day. Food is sparse.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like, you know, you're getting this feeling that people volunteered to be stranded in this clusterfuck. And you know, that there was something shifted. The Angels were getting more drunk and more fucked up. And the crowd was, you know, sort of, there was some bad drugs going around that were being passed around in a liquid form.
Right.
And it was like there was the acid was bad. It was, you know, it was there was speed involved. And that the general vibe, once the sun went down, turned dark.
Guess what, though? I just figured out was, guess who was supposed to play? The sun's got so much heat about waiting for it to get dark.
Yeah.
Who was supposed to be in that spot? That's right.
So you're thinking that the Dead, if they've just worked their fucking hippie magic,
no,
things would
that.
Have been different?
I'm not saying that, right? Although you never know, right?
Right.
But you didn't have people sitting there for an hour and a half waiting for the Stones to show up.
And now I want to read more because I found it very compelling for some reason because it, you know, Altamont is really seen, you know, alongside of the Manson murders is sort of the end of it. The end of the arc of the 60s in terms of love and peace and joy and the hippie trip.
Right.
It's where it went bad.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
Metaphorically.
Right. Sure. Fair. Why not? Right.
You know, it seemed like the Angels were involved in their own sort of like you had these younger recruits that needed to prove themselves.
Right.
And when the shit hit the fan, it was really an Angels thing. Yeah. I mean, they kill a guy.
Well, because ain't nobody going to fuck with my bike, man. That's it. That's what it was, you know? Who the fuck they think we are? These things cost nothing?
That was the end of the 60s. Stay away from the bike, man.
But listen, that was my question. When I finally figured out what my book was going to be, you know, I started...
What, this book or that book?
No, not this book. I won't talk about this
Let
book.
Let It Bleed.
But the Let It Bleed book, it was, okay, I'm going to ask everybody. It's going to start with where they're born because that was it. It was like Speed. It was like the bus movie. There were 16 people. And so you start wherever you start. You start in Sweden. You start in England. You start in America. Right. What's it like? And I didn't do it until like 30 years after. Right. So it's like.
Did it haunt you?
Oh, yeah.
Because even your pictures, it's sort of like that doesn't look safe. That doesn't look.
No. Totally haunted you. And so I asked everybody, but this is going to go right up that English. I asked Mick Taylor whether he thought it was the end of the 60s. And he said, well, it was December 1969.
Are you friends with him? How's he doing?
Well, I think everybody struggled that didn't quit.
Yeah. So, all right. So you lived through that. Several other people died of different reasons that day.
Well, there was a hit and run.
Yeah.
And
then just a real car accident.
A real car accident. Yeah. But other people could have died. That's for sure. And the possibility that you might die was on everybody's mind. There was no question about it. The scene to remember from it is in one way was so I wanted to get off the stage. So I've been on the stage every single night, right?
Yeah.
And I got on that stage. I come onto the stage, the same stage I've been on every single night.
Right.
It's like this. It's buckling. There's so many people on it.
Because the Angels are there standing in front?
Angels and on stage.
Yeah, that's right? What I mean, yeah.
You know, and them and, you know, 40 others, right?
Fans and shit.
Yeah, just people.
Yeah.
Right? And I were like, I want to be here.
And they're all wasted, right? Like chaotically wasted.
Yeah, just a mess. And Ian Stewart, do you know who's Ian?
Yeah, the piano player, yeah.
Well, except the founding member of the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, right.
He's one of the first two, Helen Bryan, right?
Yeah.
And he's on stage, I love Ian, but he one of the sort of, you know, sterner, no-nonsense guys, right? And he looks scared. That was one of the triggers.
Well, I mean, like, once the shit goes down and they can't get off stage because they got to finish playing, you know, it's kind of insane.
Totally.
Because
insane.
Do you feel that they saw what happened?
No, and I know. So I got this. Sam said, anybody who doesn't want to be here, please get off stage. Doesn't need to be here. And I was like, I don't need to be here. I got all my
After pictures. The guy gets stabbed?
No, before.
Okay.
So I'm actually taken off the stage by Hell's Angels and put up on top of the truck, and I'm standing right next to the guy that gets that footage of the stabbing, right? You couldn't see.
Was it George Lucas? I heard he was up on a hill with a camera.
Well, he might have been on the hill, but he wasn't on the truck behind the stage, right? And a lot of rumors about that show. And so so I want to get off. So I'm there for a little bit. I'm not wanting to shoot. I got some good stuff, but only because by the grace of God, right?
Yeah.
And so I get off, and I want to get to the helicopter.
Yeah.
There's one helicopter.
Yeah.
Right. There's no lights.
And it's the only way these guys can get out is the one helicopter?
The helicopter I did is all the one that's it. And the helicopter's sort of rated to take like 12 people, and there are like 16 people on it. It's so heavy that it won't take off vertically, right?
Yeah.
It sort of takes off, goes up a foot, and then drops to the ground again. You know.
You're like trying to get out of Saigon.
It was exactly like trying to get out of Saigon. And it finally gets over the hill, but just barely. Right. And there were
who's on the helicopter?
Jagger, me.
Oh, so it's after they finish.
It's after they finish. I'm there first because I'm one out of town. Right. And
because if the feeling was it was going to blow.
The feeling was you didn't know. But the feeling for me was they ain't going to wait for me. That was
sure. But so like what happened? It's funny because for some reason, Grill Marcus was there.
Right.
Before he went, he was, I guess, a nascent reviewer, or maybe just a kid.
Right.
But he actually said that, you know, after the shit went down, you know, the Stones' fear is tangible. I mean, but Keith, you know, he's tough, and you believed it. He was sort of like, get the fuck off the stage, or we're not going to play, or whatever. But you know, it's they're playing for their life. You know, those last two songs, correct?
Well, I think Jagger, who's got a... I think Jagger really saw that he was a focus, and he was, in particular, might be the one that got targeted, right? But, and I was naive enough, and this is not another
targeted
way,
by the Angels?
By anybody.
Oh, that he was going to get...
Right, yeah. I mean, he could be targeted by a teenage girl.
Right, sure.
You know, but by the Angels, sure. And Keith is not quite the same position, but I kept thinking, he tried, you know, in fairness, you know, this...
Jagger tried to cool him down?
He tried to cool him down. Nobody's listened to him,
right?
And I'm naive enough to think, well, he should be able to do something, right?
Mm.
That was just a statement of the way I thought, right?
Right.
But that's nonsense, right?
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, stop it, right? And so Keith ultimately is the one that wants to stop it, right? And, you know, depending on who you talk to, the Washington Post, big sort of effort, you know. I mean, they were with me 8 hours, right?
Yeah.
And they talked to 50 people.
This is recently?
Yeah, like 2 weeks ago.
They did it in light of the 50-year anniversary?
Same thing. But I'd never been really kind of seen, you know, like a really reputable organization really pull out the stops. And they really did, right? And it's very interesting in a lot of different ways. It gave me a perspective I didn't have. It gave me some information I didn't have.
What did Crosby say that changed your mind?
Oh, Crosby was sort of, you know, if you don't want your lunch, you don't invite a tiger to lunch.
Yeah,
but, you know, for me, so much on the inside, seeing it seen from the outside and with some with professionals asking the questions and with some distance was pretty interesting. And you saw the last picture they chose in one of the things that they did is this single individual sitting in this wasteland with just the skeleton of the stage behind him. And whether it was intentionally done to contrast with the sort of 400,000 at Woodstock or not, it tells that story as a bookend, right?
Yeah. So what was the vibe on the fucking helicopter?
Oh, just everybody's quiet, completely quiet.
Really?
Completely quiet.
Like, just sort of like, let's go.
Nothing. Just get out of here. And then they can't get out of there. And Ronnie Schneider said he pulled a gun on the helicopter guy to make him stay.
Oh, to pick everybody up because the guy, he wanted.
I'm gone, and he.
So that's like that's some Vietnam shit.
No, it was. I mean, the parallel to Vietnam, not to mention the parallel for me of blow up, because the picture of the guy with the gun is I had to blow up like just like blow up in order to really bring him to front and center.
That was your picture.
Which one now?
The of the guy with the gun.
Oh, no, no. Well, the guy with the gun that you see is not a picture. It's the film.
Right, that's right,
right,
the film.
Next
right,
to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've had to find him. I couldn't find him for years until I did that book. I finally found him, and he's small. You can see him with a green suit.
Yeah.
But I don't see the stabbing, but I see what I went and talked to the cop.
From your picture. You had him one of yours, right?
Right, right. And to the cop that opened the cold case.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
And we're talking, and the picture I have shows him talking to a guy that's sitting on a speaker right in between him and the stage.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's clearly telling him, you're right, you're in my way.
Right.
Right. So the whole sort of, you know, his innocence, it was God knows what it was. You know?
Did they ever hang it on a guy? Did the guy who killed him, the angel that did it?
Pissarro, right.
Yeah. It got tangled up, right, with a self-defense trip or what?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I heard that it was if you have a gun and you have a knife, the guy with the knife gets self-defense.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that's real, too. I think if you hadn't spent the entire afternoon sort of listening to people scream and having to deal with that chaos, he might have been a hero.
Right. Right. Yeah, interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
You know.
So you have closure around this shit now?
Yeah, I have. Closure might not be the right word. I have a sense of really having devoted a real amount of time and work to getting something that looked like the real story, you know?
Yeah, and for yourself.
For myself and because the tour, which is, again, the sort of, if you take it from a perspective, I had, you know, 18 gigs, and they were all spectacular except for that one. Right?
Yeah, and what was the, when you regrouped with the Stones in 72, which was a monumental tour.
Right.
Was it talked about?
Oh, the amount of security that was in, you know, people making sure you couldn't get an event, that everybody had security.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was so different. In 1969.
So the reaction to it was,
everybody,
never again.
Never. Right. Well, I don't know if it's true or hearsay, but the, you know, Hell's Angels that got swept off the boat trying to attack Jagger in Long Island. They got in a boat and were going to come in.
They had a vendetta. Sonny Barger had a vendetta on them.
Yeah, because
he badmouthed them.
He badmouthed them a lot. Yeah. So it's not that simple.
Right. Right.
But they definitely had it. And so the start of the 72 tour, everybody had a gun. Everybody had, everybody had a bodyguard.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Astrid, who's Bill Wyman's significant mother, had their 7-year-old in, and the guy's in there, and she offers him some tea, and she goes to make the tea, and then when she comes out, the guy is showing her 10-year-old kid his silencer.
Oh, great!
You know.
So you're on the plane for that whole thing?
Yeah. Well, for 2/3 of that tour, and then I was
love that picture of Terry Southern and Keith.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Terry was not well.
No, I know. Yeah, it's too bad.
Right.
Because, like, he was sort of an amazing talent that just got fucking destroyed himself.
Yeah, that's right. Totally. And wasn't pleasant when I met him. I mean, you know,
he wasn't well with the compulsion.
He was in, you know, in that kind of, you know, inflated, you know, egomaniac, you know, alcoholic, drug addict nonsense is kind of what it was, you know.
And, yeah, it's so funny that, you know, Keith just sort of survived them all.
Yes.
Because he was always, like, you know, oddly careful in a way, like in terms of what he was putting into his body. You know, he got the best shit.
I think there's something in that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I didn't do that stuff. That wasn't my particular thing. But because I looked dangerous to me, you know.
Yeah,
you know, and so, and also Keith has been magnificent in more recent years in terms of how generous he's been. He's been very generous with a lot of people, and both in terms of how he thought.
He's a very bright guy. Like when I read that, when I read the book, I'm like, this guy's not just some dumb junkie. It's a fucking deep dude.
Deep is a good word. And it's just that, like, I'm going to take a step 3 feet to the side and just look what it looks like from here.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And generous with that. And so the survival part of it, clearly he gets that he got lucky. The
genetics, man.
You know,
yeah,
and luck.
And luck, right, yeah. I met him. I interviewed him in I was a little beside myself, but it was pretty great.
Well, I didn't say five words to him in the whole 69 tour, and there were only 16 of us. There was just no reason, you know?
Was he a big talker?
I think if he talked about things he cared about.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so Stanley Booth, again, since they could talk Memphis and music and stuff, they talked.
Right.
But I couldn't talk that.
So now let's talk about, there's so many great things, obviously I'm not getting to in the book. We're talking about the Stones, we're talking about Lennon, we're talking about, you got Zappa in there, you got Ronstadt in there, you got the Eagles in there, you've got, I think there's a John Hyatt series in there. but these are seminal shots that a lot of people will be familiar with, but to see them all together, I like coffee table books and I like art books and I like photo books, but a lot of times when you're looking at celebrity photos, especially ones you're familiar with, you're like, do I need that? But this book I've gone back to over and over again because these are just singular pictures of these people.
Well, and I did it for my son. That's why I did it. You know, I'm 70, whatever I am, 4, and my son's 16.
Yeah.
Right? So I got a really young son, and I thought, you know, whenever I shuffle off, you know, because, you know, could be.
Sure.
You know, I wanted something for him. And so the whole thing is that I kickstarted it.
Yeah.
I controlled it completely. I spent exactly as much money as it needed to be as good as it could be.
Yeah.
And it's for him, and that's the legacy of it. And it wasn't... It was like, it's done. Do you know what I mean? I did it. He's got it. It's real. The purity of this is really interesting, and it's because you can only get it from my website.
Yeah.
I'm not giving it to, you know, Jeff
Bezos.
Publisher.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know, I'm just not, you yeah. know? It's for, right now, it's for it to be pure, and I think the purity of it is a little bit of what you respond to.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's really beautiful. It's couldn't be better printed.
What's the website?
EthanRussell.com.
It's a great gift. For your dad.
Right.
Now, come on, kids.
So I took my son when he was like 9 to the Stones in Oakland.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and he fell asleep. God bless him. Right. But the previous time that I'd been in Oakland with the Rolling Stones, my dad had been in the audience.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So it was like that thing.
Did he like it?
My dad,
yeah.
His response was, that Benny Goodman's a real, not Benny Goodman, yeah, that B.B. King's a real showman.
Oh, he opened for him?
Yeah.
Oh, there's pictures of BB in there too, and Benny Goodman in the book.
Yeah, right.
I like the thing you said about Benny Goodman is that you didn't feel like experienced enough, so you're shooting him like a rock guy.
Yeah, exactly.
You got that upshot.
I
spent my life thinking Robert Plant was 9 feet tall. they're all dwarves.
Yeah, right. You know,
it's that angle, man.
It is a hero angle.
It sure,
sure
is.
Yeah.
But okay, so in closing, how'd the pee on the wall happen?
That point, I got hired to talk to Pete to do a cover. They needed a cover. They'd had 3, didn't like them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I was at that point very much like singer-songwriter, I'm going to do something. So I spent all this time talking to Pete about Lifehouse and everything. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
They said, we need a cover. Come to the Midlands, right? They were playing some live gigs, so we did. The back cover was shot then. It's really terrible. The back cover is instantly forgettable, hence.
You're trying to remember.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Forgettable. And so we're driving back. It's in the rain. Pete drives like 100 miles an hour, crazy in the rain, right? On those roads, I scared the shit out of me. But anyway, so we're now a little caravan, not many, just 3 cars, I think, right? Uh-huh. There's none of the nonsense you have today.
Yeah.
It's just not there.
Yeah.
And so Pete's going,
and still, and it's a good shot.
And
need the nonsense.
You don't. Yeah, that's right. You can't.
Yeah.
And we driving by, and I see these shapes, and we go up there, and we do you can see it in here. They've never been published.
The shapes. Were they just these monoliths, concrete?
Today, if you go to where that is, you see this much monolith, and it's all grass.
Uh-huh.
And it was a tip, as the Brits call it, right? They put garbage in it. They fill it up.
Oh.
That's what all those were. There were a couple others off camera, right?
It's a dump.
It's a dump. It's basically a dump. And then, and so they're doing the apes, and I'm thinking the apes are cool, but
like 2001?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, because that's what it is, right?
It looks like the monolith.
It looks like the monolith.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking that's kind of cool, but don't really know what to do with it. And I'm not a guy that sits there going, this idea.
But that'd be a joke cover.
That's right.
Right.
And so I didn't think that was it.
Yeah.
And then while I'm wondering what the fuck it is, I look up and Townsend's peed on it. So Towns is real pee. The others are all film cans of water. I went, okay, got that. So, and then we did the other one. I didn't do much. It's a Hasselblad with a Polaroid back. Right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I took 14 shots.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
I said, okay, guy, let's go. And then we're driving down the motorway, and I'm thinking, oh, geez, I hope I got that, you know, because that was pretty good, you know? Yeah.
It was great. Yeah. It's a monumental cover on a monumental record. Yeah. And you did a few of them. But I honestly, like, I don't, like, we'd never met, and, you know, I don't know why, you know, I'm so happy you sent it to me, because I opened it, I'm like, what is this? And you got Keith on the cover, so right away I'm like, I'm in.
Right.
And I just love it, man. And it was like, again, I'm at the far end of the boomer thing, I really missed most of this, but when I was a kid growing up, I mean, it was what I worshipped, so it was like, oh, it's great. And great job, and it was great talking to you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Yeah, man.
All right.
There you go. Good talk. Great talk. The book is The Best Seat in the House, and it's available as a book and as an interactive digital version at ethanrussell.com. And tomorrow, meditate a little on the fact that December 6th, tomorrow, is the 50th anniversary of Altamont, the free concert where a man was killed in the Rolling Stones. Just chaos. Barely made it out. I don't know what would have happened. None of us do. And now I will play some sad music with my thumb and my other finger. I'm that's the direction I'm going. Two fingers. All right? Yep. Don't make it dirty. Boomer lives.